Chapter 35. Greg could feel his skin cooling slowly. The energy dissipator suit he wore was made from thermal shunt fibers, intended to absorb and deflect maser and laser energy, and they continually pumped out the heat his body generated. It was a one-way flow through the suit's inner insulation layer, making sure he didn't cook in his own juices. But it could get uncomfortably chilly when he wasn't moving. The hood, with its gas filters and integral photon amp, was slung over his shoulder. A cap with a throat mic and earpiece plugged him into the suit's wear and communication circuits. He watched the Bioloom strips on the subway tunnel walls slide by, throwing pulses of pink-tinged light through the coach's windows. Sinclair was always the first to get caught, sitting up in the front, his pale face suddenly printed with deep shadows, like an undertaker's doll. Julia was next, lines of exhaustion brought into unkind relief. She was also wearing one of the black form-fitting energy dissipator suits, its hood hanging down her back. Her eyes were open, showing her adrift in her own thoughts. Rick was twitching continually, unused to the cloying grip of the dissipator suit's fabric. Tension pulled his expression down into doubt, a big contrast to the anticipation shining in his eyes. After that, the fans of light swept along the row of motionless muscle armor suits standing in the aisle. There were nine of them, dull black metalloceramic humanoids. The background hum of their internal systems sounded bleakly oppressive in the small coach, an ominous reminder of how much power each of them contained. The only one Greg could recognize for sure was Susie, the smallest, standing at the head of the line with a Honeywell carbine and a Konica ripgun clipped to the waist of the suit, four Loral missiles in slim launch tubes attached behind her shoulders. The other 12 members of the crash team were riding in a second coach, directly behind them. Sinclair hadn't liked that.
"I'll not be having these demon heathens in the caves, Captain Greg. They'll be frightening the children for sure,"
he'd complained, when the muscle armor suits had marched into the security center train station.
"Tough," Greg had said. "We need them. Besides, you might wind up being glad of them. We've no idea how the alien is going to respond to our contact."
"Oh, come on now, Captain Greg. All I said was I'd show you where I was given the flower. You never said nothing about this invading army."
"They won't lay a finger on any of your followers," Julia had said. "You have my word on that."
Sinclair had gaped, features twisting into delighted astonishment.
"By all that's holy, 'tis really you."
"Yes, it's me."
"Well, now, me darling, I can hardly doubt your word now, can I?"
He had bowed as far as his portly frame allowed him. The train drew into Moorgate Station, just behind the foot of the northern end cap. Greg stepped out of the coach, finding himself in a large oblong rock chamber with six platforms laid out in parallel. It was obviously a staging area for the crews digging the second chamber. Rails disappeared up four smaller tunnels in the north wall. Beyond the last platform, there was a collection of heavy machinery laid out like a small town, lorry-sized electrical transformers, big spherical tanks, and the ribbed cylinders of turbopump casings. A criss-cross grid of 2-meter pipes, heavy-duty plastic tubes, and thick power cables led away from them into 8 service tunnels. Moorgate Station was deserted except for Bernard Kemp and a youngest WPC, who were standing waiting on the platform. Bernard Kemp's mood hadn't improved, Greg observed. The sergeant gave Sinclair a look of undisguised contempt, then started when Julia emerged from the coach. The WPC came to attention. Julia lifted her hand in an airy gesture.
"There's no need for that," she told the woman.
"We've secured the station, sir,"
Bernard Kemp told Greg as the crash team piled out of the coach.
"And the transport controller has shut down this line's traffic. There'll be no more coaches in. All the construction and mining crews in the second chamber will use the Lancaster Gate Station when they come off shift."
He watched the coach carrying the remainder of the crash team glide to a halt.
"Exactly what is going on, sir, ma'am?"
"Just like the governor says, a biohazard alert," Greg said.
"A biohazard?"
"Yeah, but not a biology we know much about, okay?"
Greg didn't even want to tell him that. God alone knew what kind of rumors it would start, but he felt he owed the sergeant something for all the inconvenience.
"Yes, sir,"
Bernard Kemp said reluctantly. His eyes kept wandering back to Julia.
"Right. Now you two take one of our coaches and report back to your headquarters," Greg told the sergeant.
He waited until the door slid shut behind them, then turned to Sinclair.
"Okay. Where now?"
Sinclair looked at the crash team and sighed.
"The Celestial Apostles. We had something good. Nothing grand, I do declare. No utopia, but we got along fine. The only quarrels were the quarrels that people should have. Little things, by the by. We all believed together, you see. That was enough to bind us.
But that was all due to change tomorrow anyway, right?
Greg asked.
Ah, now, Captain Greg, there you go again, spoiling the rhythm, just when I was working up a fine head of indignation. You're a hard man, you are. No respect.
He gave Julia a mocking smile. I'm surprised at you, a lady with vision past mine. You shouldn't be associating with the likes of him. Terribly bad for you, it is.
No, it isn't, Julia said. Greg's one of my real friends.
Oh, Holy Mary! And I'm to deliver us into your tender hands, am I? Lord, forgive me.
He dropped over the side of the platform with surprising ease and started walking down the rail towards the north wall. Greg landed lightly behind him, then turned to help Julia.
The crash team began to jump down, the resonant hammer blows of their boots hitting the rock, echoing round the silent chamber. Sinclair looked round and muttered a despairing, Jesus! Greg took the lead as Sinclair led them past the rail tunnels, heading towards the heavy machinery at the end of the chamber. A small secretion awoke his intuition and allowed him to expand his espersense. The three psychics in the crash team had used their sacks to activate their own psi abilities. They all exchanged mental grins of acknowledgement.
It was going to be one of the service tunnels that carried pipes and cables up to the second chamber, Greg decided. He whispered a request for a link to Melvin Ambler into his throat mic. Melvin, I'll go in on Sinclair's heels, but I want two of your tech specialists behind me. I'll know if we're heading into anything lethal, or if Sinclair's brewing up trouble, but there are bound to be sensors.
Roger, Melvin acknowledged. Carlos, Leslie, up front. Ms. Evans, could you and Rick move into the middle of the team, please?
Greg sensed the beginnings of resentment rustling round in Julia's mind. He ordered the communication circuit off.
Best place, he said, and held her eye.
Yeah, all right.
Sinclair walked into one of the service tunnels, a simple tube 3 meters in diameter. Inside was a remote, basic world, walls scored by the blades of the mining machine which had cut it. A meter-wide pipe fastened to the rock at waist height by solid metal brackets, cables strung from the ceiling in long hoops which made him duck every few meters. The rock was cold, leaching warmth from the air. Minute beads of condensation clung to every surface. Long, oblong grids had been laid down to give a narrow, level floor. Dim biolume panels were stuck to the wall every 5 meters. Greg could see a tiny silver trickle of water underneath the metal grid. He reckoned they'd gone about 70 meters when Sinclair halted.
"Would you be so kind as to give me a hand here, Captain Greg?"
Sinclair asked as he bent over.
"Me back isn't what it used to be."
He stuck a couple of fingers through the grid and fished up a wire hoop.
"Here we go. Just tug on that. It'll come up like a trap door."
Greg sensed a tingle of satisfaction in Sinclair's thought currents. Nothing malicious.
"I'm registering some magnetic patterns," Carlos said. "They came on when Sinclair picked up that loop. This section of the tunnel is wired. Something just above you, sir. Small and delicate. Probably a photon amp and mic. I'm jamming the processor."
"Will they know that?" Greg asked.
"Not unless it was military-grade hardware. It should just seem as though the hardware is down."
Greg couldn't believe the Celestial Apostles would use military wear.
They'd known someone was coming, but not who.
He got a grip on the hoop and pulled. It was heavier than he expected. The grid came up with a loud squeak, revealing solid darkness. He slipped the energy dissipator suit's hood over his head, feeling the wet lick of the photon amp adhering to the skin around his eyes. His universe shifted to a weathered blue and grey grisaille, and the darkness receded. There was a large crack running along the bottom of the tunnel. It had been widened below the grid, chiseled away with some kind of power tool. The jagged hole was over a meter wide, rough-hewn steps leading downwards. He bled in the infrared, adding a faint pink hue to the image. But there were no hot spots, no sign of life.
"Is there anybody on duty below?" Greg asked.
"Certainly not, Captain Greg. What would we be wanting with lookouts? We're not criminals, we're believers."
Greg hopped across the hole to Sinclair. There wasn't room in the tunnel to get past anyone. He probed round with his espersense,
The crash team invading his consciousness, a complicated melange of emotions. Nobody else.
Melvin, it's clear for the first 15 meters.
Roger. Carlos, Leslie, secure the entrance, please.
The first armored figure waddled gracelessly up to the lip of the hole, massive in the restricted width of the tunnel. Infrared picked out ruby shimmers around its joints, fluctuating at each movement. Greg wondered if any of them would be able to fit down the steps.
Carlos held out an arm and dropped a thick 10-centimeter reconnaissance disc down into the hole. Greg watched the miniature UFO swoop into the cave, its motor glowing, tracing a crimson line that curved through the air like a bent laser beam.
"No hazards visible," Carlos reported.
He started down the steps. His arms scraped the rock on either side, sending up a burst of vivid orange sparks. Greg winced. Leslie followed with more grinding noises.
"I see you don't intend on creeping up on my folk," Sinclair said.
"Is it all this narrow?" Greg asked.
"No, and you'll be going to thank the Lord for that this next Sunday."
"I might just do that."
It was unlike any cave Greg had ever seen on Earth. The rock had been split along natural fracture lines, crystalline weaknesses, stress lines, veins of metal in the ore. Greg imagined a tracery of hairline cracks spreading down from the electron compression blast crater, cancerous shadows eating through the rock, pressure differences clashing at each shockwave. Some of the internal structure around the fractures must have been compacted, while others had wrenched apart in a parody of tectonic faults, creating vast empty fissures. For every sheer surface, there was a corresponding plane above. Razor-sharp ridges had left torn gauges. The angular root pattern of shining metal veins was perfectly twinned. It was the most intricate three-dimensional jigsaw puzzle ever made. And, for the first time in his life, Greg felt claustrophobic. Floor and ceiling so obviously fitted together, they belonged together. Jaws of a vice, waiting. Sinclair waited until all the crash team came down the steps from the service tunnel, then took a torch out of his pocket.
"Now then, would you be so good as to close the grid above you there?"
The light of Sinclair's weak beam was picked up by Greg's photon amp, illuminating the cave like a Solaris spot. He saw a couple of power cables trailing out of the crack next to the steps, snaking away into the gloom. The Celestials must have spliced them into the lines up in the service tunnel.
"We'll reel out an optical cable as we go," Melvin said as the last team member pulled the grid back into place. "Keep our communications with the security center open."
"Yeah, okay," said Greg.
He gestured at the red power cables.
"Is this your power source?" he asked Sinclair.
"One of them, Captain Greg. Space is awash with energy. The light, the radiation, the wind from the sun. Bountiful it is. I'm sure Miss Julia here doesn't begrudge us this mere trickle."
"Sure she doesn't. So, where were you given the flower?"
"This way."
He started following the red cables, stepping lightly over the crumpled rock. The cave turned out to be about 50 meters across, its floor a gentle upward slope. Sinclair was heading for a bottleneck crevice opposite the stairs. There was no dust, Greg noticed. None of the little drifts of soil and bat droppings that contaminated natural caves. His initial feeling of claustrophobia was fading. Bubbling up in its wake came a twinge of expectation. Foolishly, he felt bright to the point of being cheerful. It wasn't quite his usual intuition, more like instinct. On the right path and getting closer. The same blind compulsion a salmon feels as the unique surge of fresh water from the mouth of its birth river finally flows around it. The alien. Was this the bewitchment Sinclair experienced? God knows. It was cogent enough to be mistaken for divine guidance. A grin tugged at his lips. "You're enjoying this, you idiot." A glimmer of light was shining out of the crevice ahead of him. He pulled his dissipator suit hood off, initially confused by the monochrome gloaming he found himself immersed in. A swirl of air cooled his sweaty face. The light coming from the crevice was blocked out as Sinclair moved into it. Greg hurried after him. There was a horizontal oval passage leading away beyond the entrance, its sides crimping together. Bioloom globes dangled on slim chains from the roof. Their radiance was decaying into greenish-blue, giving the wrinkled passage a biotic appearance, as if it had been grown, the inside of a giant root.
Sound would carry here, Greg knew, the rough clanking of the crash team's boots against the rock rolling on ahead of them.
"Is it worth it?" he asked Sinclair. "Living like this, hiding in caves."
"Well now, Captain Greg, we walk the park in the day, sun ourselves, dance in the rain, take our children to the beach. Nobody starves. To be sure, I even weigh in a little over the odds myself. And here we are with Miss Julia Evans herself coming to see what it is that attracts us here. 'Tis only due to people like you that we can't live in the southern endcap. Men and women have a right to live in space. We shouldn't be persecuted for exercising that right." Greg grunted and gave up.
There was another cave at the end of the passage, a big lenticular bubble of air. They came out halfway up one side, looking down on a forest of sharp, conical outcrops. Someone had left a cluster of Bioloom globes sitting on the top of the spires near the centre. Sinclair led them down to the bottom on a path which had been hacked into the rock, then straight into another passage.
"Christ, Julia, this is one badly fucked asteroid," Susie said. "This many catacombs, it's going to be leaking air all over the shop. Did you know it had so many busted rocks?"
"Seismic analysis showed there were 8 major fault zones," Julia answered. "All of them occur where different strata intersect. There were 5 deep in the interior. 2 of those got excavated to make room for Hyde Cavern. This is the 3rd. The 4th will be excavated for the 2nd cavern, and the last is down at the northern end of the 2nd cavern. We had to vitrify a square kilometre of Hyde Cavern's floor after it was excavated because it bordered on an external fault zone. And we'll have to do the same thing to the 2nd cavern when it's finished. But New London's integrity is sound."
And Royan would know about all the seismic analysis and the fault zones, Greg thought, probably more than the Celestials did. He heard the water when he was still 20 metres from the end of the passage, a suckling sound that grew with each step. The passage opened out into a cave about 50 or 60 metres across. Greg thought it must have had a deeply concave floor. The surface of the dark lake which filled it possessed the kind of stillness which he associated with depth. On the other side, a streamer of water oozed out of a fissure near the roof, slithering down the wall, making the sounds he'd heard. Ripples spread out from its base, dying away before they reached the middle of the lake.
"We're below the cavern level," Melvin said. "There must be a leak in the freshwater streams."
"Integrity, huh?" Susie murmured.
Greg trailed after Sinclair along a crescent-shaped shelf of rock that served as a shore, running 3/4 of the way round the side of the cave. A row of bright Bioloom panels on the wall above him fired harsh pink-white beams out across the lake. Serpents of reflected light twisted over the damp black walls. A flick of movement caught his eye, and he turned in time to see a ring of ripples out on the lake accompanied by a quick chop as the water came together.
"Hey, it's got fish in it," Greg said.
"Indeed there is, Captain Greg. Some of the finest rainbow trout this side of heaven. I thank the Lord for his providence every night."
Sinclair stood right by the edge of the water and crossed himself. The darkness of his thought currents were a clue to just how seriously he meant what he said.
"I found this lake, Captain Greg. It was shown to me, like Moses and his burning bush. I heard the call and brought me friends down here to sanctity and solitude where we wait for the new dawn."
"Tomorrow."
"Don't mock me, Captain Greg," Sinclair said smartly. "You know it's truth as much as I do. All of us are guided, one way or another." He raised his voice.
"Isn't that right, Miss Julia?"
The crash team had been filing out of the passage behind. Greg saw Rick and Julia emerge, both pulling their hoods off. Julia took in the cave with a stoic glance.
"I came looking for my husband," she said. "Nothing more."
"And yet this edifice you call New London cost you billions.
More billions than you'll ever see returned to your corporate balance sheet. Now why is that, I wonder? Do you see beyond the physical, Julia Evans?" She shrugged.
Sinclair carried on round the shore towards a brightly lit archway. This time the passage was much shorter, 10 metres, with a sharp right-angle turn at the end. A wave of warm, humid air blew straight into Greg's face as he turned the corner, bringing a thick, living smell of vegetation with it. Bright, hazy red light dazzled him. When he blinked the moisture from his eyes, he found himself standing on the top of a broad stone staircase, looking down on the biggest cave yet, easily 80 meters across, 20 high. A village of reed huts was clumped together on the far side. A ring of 10 big Solaris spots on the ceiling shone with a strong gold-pink light, fluorescing the thin water vapor around them into hemispherical nimbuses. A Hollywood sunset, Greg thought. The floor had been leveled and covered with jean-tailored arable moss, reminding him of Greenland. Rows of circular troughs had been built around the huts for more substantial plants. Young fruit trees were already flourishing. Trellises supported grapevines. Yellow melons hung over the edges. A herringbone network of irrigation hoses lay on the floor between the troughs, the pattern barely visible under the tide of moss. A broad square pedestal had been set up in the centre of the village, supporting 6 large flat screens in a hexagonal arrangement. The 2 facing Greg looked almost completely black, though they could be showing some tiny silver smudges. He was too far away to be certain. Children were playing around the pedestal. Adults walked about, tending to the troughs, working in an area that was obviously a communal kitchen, with aluminium tables and benches. Greg guessed at about 150 people, all told. He wasn't prepared for it. Commune mentality greens in sleeping bags, candles and campfires, huddled into dark clefts, chewing cold fruit, zombie pupae. That was the theory he'd built. But this was designer underclass, or perhaps not. Perhaps New London's innate perfection carried on even down here, a natural extension of the philosophy which suffused Hyde Cavern, Julia's principle of success with style. The Celestial Apostles did believe in the future, after all, however it diverged from the mainstream. And some of them were tech types. Sinclair started to descend the stairs, stretching out his arms, laughing wildly. "I'm back, I'm back! 'Tis me, return to you all!" The Celestials nearest the staircase turned to look, smiles turning to alarm as armor suits clumped out of the passage. Yells and cries went up.
"No, no," Sinclair shouted. "You've nothing to be afraid of. Tomorrow is come. I've brought it to you."
He reached the floor of the cave and started to gather Celestials to him, ruffling the heads of the children, embracing the adults, an archetypal tribal father.
"Look," he said. "Look," and pointed.
Julia was halfway down the staircase as the murmur of astonishment began. It spread out in a wave. The Celestials edged towards the foot of the staircase, ignoring Greg and the others. The children were shy and curious, adults incredulous. 2 of the crash team moved protectively in front of Julia.
"She knows the dawn we await is real," Sinclair said. "She came to us because our path is right."
"You should shut the old prick up," Susie's voice said in Greg's earpiece. "The daft sods will want miracles next, and we can't deliver."
"Too late," he whispered back.
Sinclair folded his arms across his chest and faced Julia.
"Behold, my kingdom, yours to command."
Julia studied the faces in front of her. They were all quiet, waiting for her to speak. Greg sensed a curious calm settle in Julia's mind.
"You have all waited a long time for this day," she said. "And it hasn't been without its trials. But tomorrow the change we all expect will come."
And she smiled warmly.
"Oh, bollocks,"
Susie said as the Celestials started to applaud.
"She's flipped. She's totally fucking flipped."
Tears were forming in Sinclair's eyes. There were calls of "How?" coming from the crowd. Greg left them behind and walked into the middle of the village for a closer look at the flat screens. The move was intuitive. All the screens were showing images of space, taken from cameras on the outside of New London as far as he could tell. There was the archipelago, and Earth, the moon, silver flowers of industrial modules.
"I didn't know who you were before," said a voice behind him.
It was the Oriental girl in the black net top who had handed him the leaflet in the Trump Nugget Castle quadrangle. She was carrying a baby, about 18 months old, who looked at Greg with wide brown eyes.
"A lot of us saw you in the cavern this afternoon," she went on. "We thought you'd stolen Sinclair from us."
"I was just looking for him. Julia Evans wanted to see him."
The girl smiled pertly.
"I can't believe that's really her. Even though I believed in Sinclair. But it's actually happening, isn't it? All the things he told us. How is she going to save us?"
It's a bit complicated. All plugged into alien technology.
He moved on round the flat screens, searching. There was something to see here, something to watch for. The impulse was irresistible.
An alien? The girl asked, intrigued. Are you making fun of us?
No, I'm perfectly serious.
Sinclair always said that our souls would be liberated by a celestial angel, and that we would be safe up here while stars fell upon the earth and smote it. And there would be locusts and plague, too. I was never really sure. Could your alien be the same thing as Sinclair's angel, do you think?
He gave the gently zany girl a sideways glance.
I've no idea. Theology and xenobiology aren't my strong points. What are these flat screens for?
So we can watch for the dawn of change to emerge from the stars.
The tone wasn't quite self-mocking, but close.
Perhaps your alien star.
The images are real-time?
Yes. Tall plugged the flat screens into the colony's datanets.
Who's Tall?
A brother.
Greg stopped in front of a flat screen showing a view of the southern hub crater. The docking spindle covered a third of the screen.
He must be a very technical lad.
Yes, he is. He knows everything there is to know about the asteroid's communication networks. He used to belong to one of the big channel companies, she giggled. He's been with Sinclair almost since the beginning. I don't think he really believes in the celestial revelation, but he contributes as much as anyone. Five of the children are his as well, including Xena here.
She bounced the softly cooing baby on her hip.
Busy man,
Greg said. One star was brightening, edging across the screen. He stared at it. And knew.
Melvin, he called.
Greg? Melvin's voice was equally urgent. Victor's online. He reckons there's a tech merc squad on the way.
The Celestial Apostles didn't like it.
The time for running and hiding is over, Sinclair protested plaintively.
Nobody is asking you to run, Melvin's voice clanged out of his suit speaker. We just want you safely out of the way.
This is our home now, Mr. Ambler. We live here. We built this place with the sweat of our brows. You may live anywhere in New London you wish after this, Julia said. That's what you told me you wanted. That I did, yes. But why do you have to wait until these monster criminals come down here? Why not waylay them somewhere else?
Greg listened to the argument with half an ear. The collective mind tone of the Celestials was nervous, and a fair proportion were practical types. They'd go. What he and Julia wanted was for Sinclair to carry on and show them where the drone had been. He suspected Sinclair was angling for concessions.
"They'd better get a move on," Susie grumbled.
She was standing beside him as he watched the space plane approach New London.
"Yeah. You gonna stay here with the ambush team?"
"Fucking right I am."
"Well, don't annoy Melvin, okay? He doesn't need it."
"Oh, thanks for the confidence. I'm fluid enough to take orders when I have to."
"Sure you are. I can read minds, remember?"
"Bollocks. All you know is that I'm pissed off with Leo fucking Riger. Don't take no genius."
"Riger's squad are bound to be in muscle armor suits. How are you going to know which one is him?"
"'Cause the bastard walks with a swagger. Even in a suit, Greg, he walks with a swagger. I'll know him when I see him."
The space plane's auxiliary reaction drive came on, a vivid white spear of plasma extending across half of the starfield. Sinclair started shouting orders, spurred by the sight. The Celestials were running round, collecting children, picking up flight bags stuffed with clothes. Sinclair grabbed one of the girls.
"Where's Tol?"
he demanded loudly.
"I haven't seen him," she said.
"Holy Mary, the lad's probably off in the caves with a girl. All he thinks about, you know,"
Sinclair told Julia.
"Terrible it is, but his heart's in the right place."
"You'll have to put someone else in charge," she said.
"Right you are there. Marcus," he bellowed. "For the love of Mary, Marcus, where are you?"
One of the Celestials rushed over to Sinclair. Greg recognized him as a member of the afternoon's leaflet teams.
"I'll send a couple of the crash team with them to make sure they get out all right," Julia said.
"That's very kind of you," Sinclair said.
Greg smiled. Even down here, Julia was automatically in charge. Eventually, the Celestials were shepherded into a single agitated group. Some of the younger children were crying. Sinclair stood on the rock staircase to talk to them, Julia at his side.
"You can't use the Moorgate station. Take them out through the Whitechapel entrance," he told Marcus. "It's the quickest from here."
"There will be some of my company security people waiting for you," Julia said. "Not the police, all right.
They'll put you up in a hotel for tonight. After that, we'll sort out where you're going to live permanently."
The space plane's plasma drive cut off, revealing a small grey triangle floating beyond the end of the docking spindle. Pinpoint twinkles of blue light flickered around its nose and began to turn in towards the crater.
"Come and get it," Susie said.
Greg's intuition seemed to have dried up. He watched the space plane manoeuvring round the spindle, free of any presentiment. Rick joined the two of them on the pedestal, giving the space plane a sober glance.
"You joining us?" Greg asked.
"Yes. It's what I came for. And I haven't been much use so far."
"Nobody expects you to hardline, Rick. Your job starts after we make contact."
The crack was slanted over at a good 20 degrees, one of several around the village cave. Sinclair had to clamber a meter off the arable moss floor before he could squeeze into it.
"Down here?" Greg asked.
And Sinclair actually seemed embarrassed about it.
"That's right, Captain Greg. The younger folk use it quite a lot, if you take me meaning. The walls on the huts there, they aren't very thick."
"Got you," Greg said.
"It opens up a bit further down," Sinclair said encouragingly. "Your tin men'll be all right after that."
"Right."
Three of the crash team were coming with them. Teresa Farrow, Jim Sharman, and Carlos Monetti. He took another look at the narrow crack. If they did meet anything hazardous in there, then targeting it would be a brute.
"Hold it, Sinclair. Carlos, you go first. I want firepower available if push comes to shove."
"Yes, sir," Carlos said gladly. He clamped his gauntlets on the side of the crack and walked himself up. Little splinters of rock spilled down.
Someone had found the controls for the Solaris spots. They flared white, throwing everything into sharply defined contours. Melvin was busy organizing his crash team, sending them ranging into the village and exploring the other cracks and fissures leading out of the cave.
"Hey, Greg," Susie said. "Give Royan's ass a kick from me, okay?"
"No messing."
Sinclair wriggled into the crack after Carlos. Greg levered himself up. The alien's presence was a cold, burning star ahead of him, exerting a gravity which acted on his thoughts alone, pulling him on. He sucked in his belly and slipped into the crack.